This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Okay, I'm at Astrofest and I'm talking to Dr. Jim Wild. Hi, Jim.
Hi there, how you doing?
Okay, thanks, and welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've been talking this morning at Astrofest about space weather and the sun. Can you just tell us a little bit about your involvement as a space scientist in space weather?
Yeah, sure. Well, space weather is really interesting. It's what we generally think of the changes in the space environment that surrounds all the planets in the solar system with space weather. So obviously the sun's driving this all space weather in our solar system. And then just like weather on Earth, it changes from time to time in sort of hours, minutes, seconds, years, months. So we have a whole range of timescales and spatial scales on which we have to try and understand these variations in the environment around that planet. Then the really crucial thing is then to figure out how those couple into our planet. So this, you often hear space weather experts and space scientists talking about geo-effectiveness. So it's not only understanding how big the coronal mass ejections might be or how fast they're moving, but understand just how well they couple into our own planetary system and then feed energy into the inner parts of the Earth's magnetic field system.
Right, so how exactly would coronal mass ejection, you said there, which is an ejection of huge amounts of plasma from the sun heading to out into space, and sometimes they head towards the Earth, how does that actually couple to the Earth then?
Well, if you just take a vanilla-flavoured coronal mass ejection, so the sort of your average thing, it's about a billion tons of plasma moving about 500 kilometres a second. So it takes about 4 days to get to the Earth. So sometimes we can see them coming, sometimes we can't. But when that arrives, the first thing it does is it will compress the day side of the Earth's magnetic field. And in fact, the whole cavity that the Earth sits in the solar wind, the magnetosphere, gets compressed by just this impact from a huge amount of material. But the crucial thing then is, inside that coronal mass ejection, there'll be some remnants of the magnetic field from the sun. And the exact orientation of that can make a big difference. So we all know that with regular weather, if you have snow falling onto a cold, dry road, the effect will be very different than if it lands on a warm, wet road. So it doesn't matter, the same amount of snow will give you a very different effect. With a coronal mass ejection, the amount of field wrapped up, and the orientation of the field wrapped up in that ball of plasma.
So this has come from the sun with the plasma.
With the plasma. So the two things are what we call frozen together. That will make a really big difference, because if that magnetic field is oppositely directed to the Earth's own, then we all know that from simple bar magnets, that oppositely oriented magnetic fields will interact really strongly. And so that'll be very effective at peeling away the front side of the Earth's magnetic field and slamming into the inner parts of the magnetosphere. If on the other side, on the other hand, it's parallel to the Earth's magnetic field, so we have a northward magnetic field inside the CME, then actually the coupling won't be very good across the boundary and we'll get some force field effect. So yeah, we're going to get walloped, but we'll still get that protection effect of the Earth's magnetic field. So it's not just seeing them coming, we've also got to figure out what's in them, how they travel, and how those properties change as they're on their way towards us.
Okay, so if there's a mass ejection from the sun and it hits the Earth, what sorts of effects do we experience on the Earth? What problems can that cause?
Well, the main effect of the coronal mass ejection will be that it will probably trigger what we call a geomagnetic storm. So we're compressing the Earth's magnetic field inside its bubble in the solar wind, and that compression means it gets stronger. So all the magnetic field lines get close together. So we see a strengthening of the Earth's magnetic field, and then also, we have to keep remembering that most of what goes on inside in the magnetosphere in terms of accelerating particles in and creating things like the aurora, most of those are processes inside the magnetosphere. The magnetosphere is a bit like an enormous particle accelerator. And when it gets walloped by coronal mass ejection and gets compressed and strengthened, really the knob gets turned up to 11 there. The acceleration processes get much more efficient and much stronger. And also there's a huge population of plasma that's being funneled into the system. So actually we start to see that the aurora will brighten. We'll see very strong aurora. Sometimes, I mean, during a large event that Carrington observed in 1859, you can see the aurora down far south as Cuba and the southern parts of the southern states of the USA. So the aurora will expand hugely as the energy coming into the polar regions gets much greater. But also we'll start to see in our modern technology-driven society, things like radio communications can become a bit more problematic. Airline flights crossing the polar routes will also have to start taking into account increased radiation dosage and the poor communications environments up there. We can induce very large currents in power grids, which can be a problem for some of the transformers to cope with, so we have to take that into account. And of course all our space infrastructure will also start to feel the effect of a slightly expanded and increased density atmosphere as the Earth's atmosphere warms up slightly from the increased energy input. Problems like low Earth orbit satellites feeling higher drag.
Things like the ISS as well.
Things like the ISS will also become a little bit more sensitive to these events, because basically the increased radiation doses in the inner magnetosphere go up slightly. So you'll find that the astronauts will probably be encouraged to go into those parts of the station where they have higher degrees of shielding from the radiation at the time.
And you're involved in a few experiments that look from the ground, and there's experiments in space that monitor the sun. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, sure. Well, the real trick with things like magnetosphere and space weather is it's really difficult to fill in the gaps between the measurements. And a great analogy is imagine trying to make measurements of the weather on Earth, the regular climate and the weather, with only half a dozen thermometers scattered all over the surface of the Earth. It'd be very difficult. And so we have a few instruments in orbit, so probably a couple of dozen satellites in orbit around the Earth. We have a handful of satellites that are constantly looking at the sun. And so we're able to augment those with instruments on the ground. So looking up into the magnetosphere along the magnetic field lines that come down to the surface of the Earth. And so the nature of that means that most of those kind of instruments are located in the auroral regions around the north and the south magnetic pole. So we have, for example, very large powerful radar systems to probe the materials it rains in. Obviously lots of optical equipment to take pictures of the aurora, because the aurora is just a symptom of what's going on out in space. So if we look at, for example, motions in the aurora, boundaries, brightenings, intensity, we can map that out along the magnetic field line and see where the source regions are coming from in space. So really looking on the ground, we're looking at the symptoms in the same way that a doctor studies a patient in order to understand more about the disease and how it moves.
Do you get much chance to go up to near the North Pole to do some observations by eye as well?
Yeah, well, the science being what it is now, a lot of our equipments are run remote routinely, so we have a host of cameras. So out of Lancaster, I run three images in Iceland and the Faroe Islands, but that couples up with the international effort. So at the moment, the US guys have a large array of cameras spanning Alaska and Canada. Our Scandinavian colleagues have been doing this for a very long time, obviously, because they're in just the right place. So yeah, so we get it to go up to quite often to northern Norway, up to Spitsbergen in Svalbard, also to Iceland, and they're really fantastic environments, an amazing place, amazing opportunities to go and work there. It's just beautiful.
I'm very jealous. I've only seen aurora from Cheshire, and that's as good as I've got.
Yeah, I always say it's something you really have to do before you die, get to the aurora. And people always come and say, when they ever hear me talking about the aurora, where's a good place to go and see it? So yeah, we generally say try and get somewhere like not Iceland or northern Scandinavia. Often around the equinoxes is good, because you want to balance that good weather against good viewing conditions. Summer's no good, obviously, because it's permanent daylight.
Yep.
And so, and then you just, it's a bit like whale watching. You pay your money and you take your chance and you wait and hope.
Now, you mentioned there are a few spacecraft observing the sun. One of them is just about to go up as we record this, the Solar Dynamics Observatory. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Solar Dynamics Observatory is going to be really interesting, because it's mainly aimed at helping us understand those processes that go on the sun that give us those dynamics. So the things that cause flares and cause coronal mass ejections. So and also the underlying processes that give the sun its 11-year solar cycle. We know that every 11 years the sun goes from a very obvious minimum activity through a maximum back to minimum again. And you can characterise that in various ways, a good one being the number of sunspots you see. But we don't really know why that is. We've been observing it for hundreds of years, and we've got various ideas, various theories. Obviously, modelling and theory plays a big part in this, but we still don't really have a clear understanding of why it has the most basic dynamics. So SDO should really help us to understand those by making really in-detail measurements of the actual dynamics on the sun, not just the static picture.
Right, well, thank you very much for talking with us today. We wish you the best of luck with IceCat and the other experiments you're involved with.
Cheers.